To mark the National Day of Resilience and the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, Yemenis have organized multiple events across the country. This year, they are also expressing their support for the people of Palestine as Israel carries out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. Several high-ranking officials participated in these events.
Today, we celebrate the steadfastness and standing up against an aggression that has continued for years. We are defending ourselves and resisting politically, economically and militarily in the face of the barbaric aggression in which the whole world has allied with, and a siege that is still in place. Although 9 years have passed, the aggression is still ongoing and the siege has not stopped. Therefore, we will continue to stand together until the war stops completely.
Officials state that the Saudi-led war continues despite failing to achieve its stated objectives. They argue that the U.S. does not want the war to end, aiming to subdue the Yemenis, especially after Yemen began its naval operations in support of Palestine.
There are lots of agendas that were not achieved by the war on Yemen, and therefore America wants to at least reach the rest of its goals regarding Yemen. But the truth is that a Yemeni victory has been achieved, and we have imposed our presence. We united in political, military, and social level, so Yemen succeeded in absorbing the strategic transformations, imposing itself in the Red and Arabian Seas, and supporting the Palestinian cause. America has no choice but to accept this reality.
In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni army reported 6 military operations over the past 3 days. These operations included targeting 3 American and British vessels with missiles and drones in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, while another vessel heading to Israeli-occupied ports was also hit. The Yemeni army also launched an attack on 2 U.S. destroyers. Yemeni forces also successfully struck the occupied territories with ballistic missiles.
After 9 years of U.S.-backed war and siege, observers believe that Yemen today is stronger than ever, being the only country to have supported Palestine through military action. They argue that Yemenis are confident they are on the right path as long as Washington continues to bombard and terrorize them. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For more than 170 days, the Israeli operations in the besieged Gaza Strip have resulted in the deaths of more than 32,000 individuals. The latest incident involves an attack on Al-Shifa Hospital, where witnesses have reported extensive atrocities. In reaction, Iranians assembled in front of the Turkish embassy on Monday to voice their indignation.
People gathered here to condemn Israeli genocide in Gaza, urging Muslim states, including Turkey, to halt exporting energy to the regime.
Participants lament that the international community has thus far remained silent regarding Israel.
We as women have come here with our children because we witnessed the Israeli action against Palestinian women and children. Sadly, the international community has remained silent.
Regrettably, Turkey as a Muslim nation exports significant raw materials, including metal, to Israel. If Turkey were to cut off this supply and prevent exports to Israel through the Ceyhan port, it would exert considerable pressure on Israel. We also call on other Muslim countries like Azerbaijan, which supplies 40% of Israel's oil, to cease their support.
This plea follows Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, urging Muslim nations to cut political and economic ties with Israel. Protesters also cited Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, who highlighted the role of Muslims in opposing Israel by saying, "If the Muslims of the world united and each poured a bucket of water, Israel would be washed away." Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa Fluid Battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemy's crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies.
Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the Prime Minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The Prime Minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission, purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stations some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witness the calls by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the Prime Minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide and rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowruz that has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Nowruz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Nowruz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Nowruz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Nowruz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Nowruz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods, and you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Nowruz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Nowruz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Nowruz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity and kindness.
Nowruz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Azmi, Islamabad.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome. Now, the only effective and efficient way to deliver heavy goods to meet Gaza's humanitarian needs is by road, and that includes an exponential increase in commercial deliveries. Now, these are not my words, but the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who made the comments during his visit to Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisum Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims and forcing the men to watch it. That's, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with a lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered basically a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, the enemy of the people of Esther. So every year this holiday is celebrated, And it's not just extending to Persians, but anybody who they view as their enemy. This is like celebration of revenge. It's very, you know, very, very sick stuff. And it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen to happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, to relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself, the very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization, just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well, the Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, a fertility goddess, if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance, because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest, and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims and the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel, because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm actually very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the axis of resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
But that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon, and even now we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that. Again, a few days cleans up. Now, this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guests in Los Angeles spoke about. This optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. This is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned. And now their true colors have been known to the entire world, so they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in. And the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much, unfortunately, compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where we also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now, but again, very difficult.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for a humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. But we see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. And they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened, because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed the second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran, and to a lesser extent Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansarullah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically Russia and China will have no problem with Ansarullah. And Ansarullah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansarullah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran. In order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate the spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate the spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions, people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy. And then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism. And thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansar Allah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate tension, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
In the United States, the Border Patrol chief has warned the migrant crisis is a national security threat and says his biggest fear is not the 1 million people apprehended so far this year, but the 140,000 known gotaways. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has called the situation at the southern border with Mexico a national security threat, expressing concern about tens of thousands of migrants who have evaded apprehension and entered the United States surreptitiously over the past 5 months. Jason Owens said Border Patrol is closing in on recording 1 million apprehensions of migrants in between ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border in the 2024 fiscal year, which started last October. For the third consecutive year, his agency is on track to record 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends at the end of September, Owens said. That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. But Owens asked, why are they risking their lives and crossing in areas where we can't get to? Why are they hiding? What do they have to hide? And what are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from? We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things, for us, are what represent the threat to our communities. The situation, Owens added, amounts to a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, added, and if we don't know who is coming into our country and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat, and they're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. However, Owens agreed that the vast majority of migrants coming into the United States border are good people. I think the migrants that we encounter that are turning themselves in, yes, I think they absolutely are, by and large, good people. I wish they would choose the right way to come into our country and not start off on the wrong foot by breaking our laws. While a very small amount of these apprehended at the southern border are serious criminals, such as those convicted of murder or other serious crimes, Owens said most migrants are surrendering themselves to Border Patrol agents to escape poverty or violence in their home countries. They're coming across because they're either fleeing terrible conditions or they're economic migrants looking for a better way of life, he said. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP statistics show a tiny fraction of migrants processed by Border Patrol have criminal records in the United States or other countries that share information with American officials, and an even smaller percentage have been convicted of serious crimes. Available data and studies also suggest that migrants in the United States illegally do not commit crimes at a higher rate than native-born Americans. Still, top law enforcement officials, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, have voiced concerns about criminal actors, including potential terrorists, exploiting the unprecedented levels of migration along the U.S. southern border with Mexico over the past 3 years. In both fiscal years, 2022 and 2023, Border Patrol reported over 2 million apprehensions of migrants who crossed the southern border illegally, both all-time highs. Jason Owens said the extraordinary flow of people into the United States is mainly driven by cartels. Asked if cartels were setting the rules of engagement at the southern border, Owens said, yes, they absolutely are. The New York Post has also covered this same story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owen said the migrant crisis has become a serious national security threat, as terrorists may be slipping across the border with Mexico and smugglers dictate the flow into the United States. They dictate what the flow is going to look like, and we respond to it, Owen said in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday. He said, "We try and get out in front of it and deny them the ability to use these areas. But at the end of the day, there's over 1,900 miles of border with Mexico." Under the Biden administration, the United States has endured record levels of migrants pouring across the southern border with Mexico, including thousands who claim asylum and are then released into the country. Border Patrol has reported 1,151,000 encounters at the southern border, according to the most recent tally of numbers through the 2024 fiscal year. The prior year saw 2,475,000 cases, according to the agency. Owens fretted that there could be terrorists and other dangerous people slipping through the system. "That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. It's not part of that," he said, referring to the official count, "and that's just what we know." That is a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, and if we don't know who is coming into our country, and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat. They're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. The border chief noted that most of the encounters are with individuals who are turning themselves in and are fleeing dire economic conditions at home. That doesn't make them bad people, it's just that they're not being respectful of the laws that we've established as a country, he said. Jason Owen stressed that there are dangerous people buried in that population that do pose a risk to the United States. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. The US Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has said the crisis at the southern border with Mexico is a national security threat that keeps him awake at night, in a new interview during which he spelled out the danger posed by millions of illegal migrants who've entered the country in recent years. The US Border Patrol is mere days away from hitting 1 million apprehensions of migrants in fiscal year 2024, which began for the US government last October. "What's keeping me at night awake is the 140,000 gotaways," Owen said. "The number of migrants who have sneaked into the country undetected since last October." But he asked, "What are they hiding? What do they have to hide? What are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from?" Owens explained, "are the primary concerns of the US Border Patrol about the gotaways, whose backgrounds and locations are virtually unknown to the US government." "We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things for us are what represent a threat to our communities," he said. Jason Owens said his department is on track to record some 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends in September. The US Border Patrol chief said border security is a big piece of national security, and the illegal migrants being smuggled into the country are exploiting a vulnerability facing the nation at present time. He said migrants who've made their way into the United States this year have come from at least 160 different countries, some of which are many continents away. Routes from Europe and Asia lead to the Darien Gap in Panama, a popular starting point for smugglers leading large groups of migrants north through Central America and eventually into the United States.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Israeli forces kill scores of Palestinian civilians in indiscriminate strikes across Gaza, as the total death toll from the regime's genocide exceeds 32,600. A new report says the Biden administration has quietly authorized the transfer of billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel in recent days.